Well, good morning, everyone. If you can hear me, counsel, wave your hand at me, would you please? Okay, very good. We are going to show you before we begin the case a little bit how time is kept. So if you look at the corner of your screen that has a view that just says Wisconsin Supreme Court, when it's time for you to start, you will see a card that's green, looks like this, says start. When you have 5 minutes to go, you get a yellow 5 minute card. And when it's time to stop, you get a red stop card. Now, I will let you answer the rest of your answer to a justice's question, but prevent you from going into another area when the card said stop. So we'll all try to work together to see if we can manage this, but it has worked fairly well in the past. So are you both ready to begin?
Yes.
Okay, very good. Then I'll call our case, Mones versus BMO Harris Bank. Now, you will notice that the court sits five on this matter. Justice Annette Kingsland Ziegler is not participating, and Justice Brian Hagedorn is not participating. So that is why we are sitting five. And counsel, if you are ready to proceed, please do.
Yes, Your Honor. This is Michael Apfeld of Godfrey & Kahn on behalf of petitioner BMO Harris Bank. With me at virtual counsel table is Ms. Linda Coberly of Winston & Strawn. Ms. Coberly will be presenting argument today for the court.
Very good. Counsel, are you prepared to begin?
Chief Justice Robinson, I'm not sure her audio is connected.
Yep. Yeah, she's trying to connect. I see that. If you have a way, Attorney Apfeld, of contacting her by phone or something, tell her we're waiting for her.
I will do that, Your Honor.
There she is.
Are you connected now to audio, Attorney Coberly?
I am, and I'm okay. Sorry.
Okay. It's not a problem. I don't know if you were watching when we showed the cards for starting, stopping, and being okay.
Yes,
you were.
I'm familiar
okay,
with it.
Okay, very good. So if you are prepared to begin, then please do.
I am, Your Honor. Thank you very much, and may it please the court. The court granted review here to consider three discrete legal issues. The first is whether the court can impose liability as a sanction for conduct that caused no prejudice. The second is whether damages can be awarded for a breach of contract and unjust enrichment. And the third is whether a finding of punitive damages can rest on contract or quasi-contract liability with no tort liability, much less evidence of tortious conduct performed maliciously or with wanton disregard. The trial court got all of these issues wrong. And as a result, my client faces nearly $1 million in damages for a case that at its bottom is really about $40,000 in unpaid invoices. All of this is without any evidence of misrepresentations to the respondent or any other misconduct in the party's business dealings.
So are you now challenging the trial court's conclusion of law that there was misrepresentation by your client? That was one of the questions on the special verdict. Are you challenging that yes answer?
Yes, because the only basis for that finding was a discovery sanction. And that has been part of our argument from the beginning. There was never a factual finding that there was a misrepresentation. In fact, today...
It depends on how you interpret the record, but I've read the record, and I'm sure you've read it many times, so...
Indeed, Your Honor. But the...
I have a couple of questions, but let me take you, since Chief Justice Rogan-Sack asked that first one. As far as the misrepresentation claim goes, I know you're contesting it, but is it your understanding that that misrepresentation claim stems from the statements made on behalf of your client that Mones would in fact be able to draw money from the loan? Is that your understanding of what the claim is?
I'm not sure what the claim is, Your Honor, and we've never been sure. In fact, at the beginning of the trial counsel for BMO specifically asked the court, could you please give us a finding of what are the facts that you are concluding and assuming against us? What is the basis for the misrepresentation so that we can have a coherent trial direct our case toward that, and the court refused to say what the misrepresentation was.
So I don't have the complaint in front of me. Are you telling me that that's not part of the complaint? Misrepresentation wasn't a way in which they were seeking relief? I thought that it was.
Is that incorrect? Well, it was, Your Honor, but what the focus was on this statement that there was $223,000 available to be drawn, and that was true. That is a true statement, and everyone agrees that that statement was true. So that couldn't have been the basis for the misrepresentation claim. By the time we got to trial, the discovery process had defeated that allegation and had shown that the amount available to be drawn was in fact that number exactly to the penny. So that was not a misrepresentation.
Counsel, paragraph 31 of the complaint sets forth the misrepresentation. Am I correct? And is that your basis of the understanding of their misrepresentation?
Pulling it out in front of me, Your Honor. That is the basis of what was alleged as the misrepresentation, yes.
We don't know
what facts. So ordinarily, Your Honor, when there is an adverse inference drawn, there's an adverse inference drawn on specific facts, and those facts are articulated by the judge. The judge may say, for example, if evidence was destroyed on a particular point. If evidence was destroyed, then the judge will assume that the content of that evidence supported what the plaintiff said it did. If someone hides a particular document, there may be an adverse inference about what that document says. But it's something specific. It's a fact. What happened here is that the judge concluded that there should be a discovery sanction and found against my client on every point without saying what facts were being assumed. And of course, by the time we got to trial, there had been development of facts. So for example, there were facts showing that that amount was available. There were facts showing that there were certain conditions on the draw of funds. For example, funds had to meet a certain set of requirements. And here, by the way, there was no evidence that the draw for the funds met those requirements. In fact, the court in the prior case specifically held that they had not met those requirements. For example,
Now let's not get into the prior case. I think we have enough trouble with the case that's before us.
Very good, Your Honor.
I want to direct your attention to the first issue that you raised, and that is that you are wanting us to make a requirement now in our case law that all types of sanctions would have to have, of sanctions involving liability, would have to have egregious conduct. But that really flies in the face of our case law, which separates the egregious from the negligent. And I'm sorry, so that the finding of prejudice is only tied to the negligent conduct, whereas egregious conduct, our case law makes pretty clear that we don't have to do that. So I'm not sure you're asking us to really uproot case law. Is that right?
No, I disagree, Your Honor. The court noted the distinction, the kind of distinction we're talking about, between a dismissal of liability and a dismissal of a sanction of liability and a sanction of dismissal. In the Chevron case in 1997, there the court talked about Johnson, which is the case that's at the center of what the respondent is arguing here. And it said, yes, Johnson said there's no per se rule requiring prejudice. Deloitte said Johnson didn't apply because in that case involved a sanction of dismissal. The court said it didn't need to reach the issue because there was clearly prejudice in that case. But the court did reach that issue in Split Rock. And it said that prejudice is required. It said prejudice must be considered and found before the court weighs default judgment as a sanction. And that's because of the basic principle that the law prefers, whenever possible, to afford litigants a day in court and a trial on the issues. Now, it is true that in Split Rock, the nature of the conduct was different than it is here, of the alleged conduct. We actually quite disagree that that this case is so clearly not negligence. I think if we get into the discovery discussion, I will be able to show you that what happened here is the same kind of dispute about discovery that happens in every case. What's really at issue in the corporate representative deposition? What are really the requirements for a corporate representative deposition and that kind of thing? But what the case what Split Rock actually talked about was a requirement that prejudice be considered, because that case involved a sanction that interfered with the court's interpretation of and ruling on the merits of the case. And the reason that should be the rule and is the rule under Split Rock is because it's an essential part of making sure the sanction is just under the circumstances. If the discovery conduct made it necessary to file motions, a just sanction might be to award fees to respond to those motions. If the discovery conduct destroyed evidence on a particular point, a just sanction might be to create an adverse inference on that particular point. But if the discovery conduct had no effect at all on respondent's ability to prove its case, a sanction that says respondent has proven his case is not a just sanction.
Attorney Coberly, it seems to me in reviewing this record that if it was just one of the instances that you just laid out, where they didn't answer, they didn't respond to something in discovery, that would be one thing. The conduct here, though, in addition to the type of conduct here, it was that it was happening over and over and over again. You can feel the frustration of the trial judge in reading the record. What was she to do? What else was she to do? She gave warning after warning, and your client didn't comply with discovery, didn't have the people show up at depositions with any knowledge of what was going on in these transactions. The lawsuit couldn't go on because of the conduct of your client.
Well, Your Honor, first of all, it's quite clear the judge was frustrated, and I don't disagree with that. That comes through loud and clear in the transcript, but remember what the dispute was about. It was about whether a corporate representative needed to have been personally involved in the transaction. That's what both the respondent and the court were concerned about. And that's just not required for a corporate representative deposition. I mean, we have a situation where the people who were intimately involved in what this discovery was, what the dispute was about at this point, the people who were intimately involved had retired from the company. They weren't there anymore. So what respondent did was notice a corporate representative deposition. And under the rules, and indeed under the court's specific instructions at the hearing in March, what the corporate representative needed to do was either have personal knowledge or do their best to familiarize themselves based on the documents. That's what a corporate representative deposition is. And yet what both the respondent and the court were frustrated about were answers to questions like, were you personally involved in the transaction? And of course the answer was no, because for a corporate representative deposition, that's not what's required. And in fact, the people who were most involved, and the corporate representative said the person who's most involved is Dan Kaminsky. Dan Kaminsky doesn't work at the company anymore. Now, what really strikes me about this is when the court, even though the court entered a dispositive sanction, the court entered no findings and made no analysis of what else the corporate representative could have done to prepare, whether someone else at the company would have had more personal information, whether her lack of knowledge precluded the respondent from getting information critical to the case. Maybe the information could have come from documents. Maybe the respondent could have issued a subpoena to the retiree, who, by the way, did end up testifying at trial. There was plenty of time. There were months before the trial date, and there was no analysis of any of this. So the dispute we have, there's no dispute that a corporate representative prepared, read documents, and came to the deposition. The dispute is about the level of personal knowledge. And I want to really draw a contrast between that situation and the types of cases that in the past have produced a dispositive sanction. In Marquardt, this court's case from 2007, The party filed the suit and then refused to provide any documents in discovery at all, despite multiple sanctions orders awarding fees that the party refused to pay. In Brandon Apparel in 2001, the party refused to be deposed altogether and stonewalled interrogatories right up until trial, depriving the claimants of evidence central to the case. In Johnson, a party refused for 2 years to provide a list of witnesses, deposition dates, and damages. In Chevron versus Deloitte, there were four different discovery sanctions with lesser consequences, followed by misrepresentations about witness unavailability for trial and a violation of a sequestration order and refusal to comply with rules about objections and accusations about opposing counsel in front of the jury. And only then did the court enter a dispositive sanction, having made an effort to do lesser sanctions and not gotten anywhere.
And in none of those cases, counsel, was there a requirement that prejudice be found, correct?
Actually, prejudice was found in all of those, in most of those cases. There wasn't you're correct, because it wasn't until Split Rock that the court said prejudice should be found.
And Split Rock was a negligence case. So we're still, you want us to make brand new law that says that no matter what, whether it's negligence or egregious conduct, that a finding of prejudice has to be made before a court could dismiss or find liability.
Well, I would like there to have been findings here to explain why this was not a negligence case itself, because again, there are no findings here. So, and that by itself makes this sanctions order effectively unreviewable. And that would be a basis.
I'd like to direct your attention to parts of the transcript where the trial court went through BMO Harris's responses to requests for information by the plaintiff, and one by one said, this was the request, and then the court said, but you lied. This was the request, but you lied. There were several of them. I can't tell you how many, but several pages of that. And the court pointed out that that was clearly a misrepresentation by BMO Harris, and that why that kind of conduct during the course of discovery should be tolerated, frankly, is a mystery to me.
Your Honor, what's puzzling to me about that section of the transcript, and I know the section you're referring to,
right,
is that in general, if there's a problem with a response, that's something that's explored at trial. It is not for the court in the discovery process to make a credibility determination about whether a witness or a party is or isn't telling the truth about the matters that they're speaking about. That's an issue for the trial. You go to the jury to resolve that.
What law do you rely on for that premise that the court can't make credibility determinations?
The Seventh Amendment, Your Honor. There needs to be a jury trial on credibility issues and on whether a witness, that's what a jury trial is for. What the court did here was say that,
having been in a few scores of jury trials personally, well, that's not true, 20 to 30 as an advocate, and probably a few scores of jury trials, I understand jury trials, and I understand the credibility of the witness, and I understand the jury instruction that the jurors are the sole determination of the credibility of the witnesses. But things happen before jury trials. In fact, very few cases go to jury trial. And so the court, in its motion practice, which is really the kind of epicenter of civil practice these days, discovery and motions, has to make credibility determinations. You think the court's without authority to make credibility determinations pre-trial in motion practice?
I think in the context of discovery, and that's what we're talking about, Your Honor, the court could make a credibility determination, I suppose, about a response about discovery, a question about that would be a discovery violation. So if the question were, did you produce the documents, and the court found the answer to be not credible, that might be the basis for an appropriate discovery ruling. But when what the court is doing is saying, I'm listening to you, witness, talk about the facts of this case, and I don't believe you, therefore I, the judge, am simply going to enter judgment against you with no motion for that pending. There was no motion to compel on those the things that were the subject of the findings. And by the way, the findings that you're referring to, Justice Roggensack, were findings after trial. Those were not findings made at the time of the discovery sanction.
I understand exactly when they were made. Thank you.
Okay. The issue I have with the findings, Your Honor, is that there wasn't a, first of all, there isn't a very clear finding on what it is that was insufficient about the corporate representative deposition. Again, the problem was a lack of personal knowledge. Those were the questions that the respondent was concerned about. But there was also no finding to support the standard that this court has followed for egregiousness for some time, which requires, which includes looking at whether there was a conscious attempt to affect the outcome of the litigation. That's one of the things that we look at in terms of determining whether there's egregious conduct. And without even considering the relationship between the information sought and whether the respondent was able to present its case at trial, it is difficult to see how the court could have found that BMO was attempting to affect the outcome of the litigation. And in fact, the court did not state that finding. All of the issues that came up here, again, are the kinds of issues that parties encounter in every case. The appropriateness of a redaction, the timing of production, questions about the level of preparation of a corporate representative witness. These are in the category of normal discovery conversations, and you would expect to be the subject of some motions to compel and so forth. The only motion to compel filed in this case was filed after the close of discovery, and it dealt with redactions, and it dealt with a corporate representative who again, the complaint was that the corporate representative didn't have personal firsthand knowledge of some of the things he was asked about. That's the motion to compel that was filed. The judge ordered a new corporate representative deposition, and BMO complied with that.
I want to move you to the second question. So I'm looking at the verdict form right now, and it's pretty clear that to answer the question regarding unjust enrichment, which was number 5, the jury was told, regardless of how you answered the previous question and without duplicating amounts from that question, answer this question. So my question to you is, why are you saying that the $132,668 award from number 5 includes the amount awarded under the contract damages in number 4? Because so you're saying you can't recover both, but why do you think that includes the other?
So the argument that you can't recover both is a little bit different than just saying that the actual amounts are included twice. The reason that it's double dipping is because it requires assuming inconsistent facts. In order for there to be any unjust enrichment, there has to be a conclusion that there was no contract. In order for there to be breach of contract damages, there has to be a conclusion that there isn't.
Why? That does not make sense to me, because my understanding of the unjust enrichment, that it's the benefit conferred, which what they had actually had an appraisal for $300,000. It looks like the jury may have subtracted the amounts from 4 to get to the 132. So why is the benefit conferred the amount of the contract? The contract was for the draw of the $40,000.
We've cited a number of cases, Your Honor, that to the point that the doctrine of unjust enrichment does not apply when there is a contract. And that's because the parties, if there is a contract, then the parties have agreed to the terms of what their relationship will be and agreed about what the consequence will be of the promise that's made and the agreement to perform. And it's factually inconsistent.
So you're arguing that it can never, I get the argument, I understand, and I've read the cases. I don't read them to say that you can never have unjust enrichment and contract damages as long as those damages are not the same. You could still be unjustly enriched separate and apart from the contract, correct?
Only if the contract doesn't, by definition, having an unjust enrichment claim is an equitable claim, and the equitable claim doesn't exist if the party's relationship is governed by a contract instead. So, for example, if I enter into a bad contract, suppose I enter into a terrible contract, it turns out to have been very unfair for me. I can't go to court later and say, please relieve me of my choice to enter into this contract because it turned out to be unfair. And that would be an unjust enrichment claim layered on top. If the parties have a contract, those are the terms that govern, and you can't then look to the law in equity to provide an additional remedy. And that's, we've cited the restatement on restitution and unjust enrichment, the Schweigel case, the Gage case out of the Court of Appeals. And in fact, those cases say that that you can't have a situation where a party pursuing a breach of contract claim is also allowed to pursue damages for unjust enrichment at the same time. That's exactly what the court addressed in Schweigel and Gage. And looking back to the Watts case, it's clear that the unjust enrichment claim is fundamentally separate and inconsistent with the notion that the parties have an agreed contractual relationship that defines who will get what based on what conduct.
In other words, counsel, courts only look to equity in the absence of a contract, correct?
Correct, correct.
It's exactly. Sort of a Schrodinger's cat situation, if I can delve into quantum mechanics. We cannot both say there is a contract and therefore award contract damages and then say there is not a contract, so we are going to award equitable damages.
Correct. That's exactly right, Your Honor. And in fact, I mean, even if you could have a situation where two kinds of damages are awarded, just asking the jury not to duplicate doesn't really protect against the argument on appeal. But what you've pointed out, Your Honor, is that there's a fundamental inconsistency. It's not just a question of subtracting the contract damages. There's a fundamental logical inconsistency between a recovery for those two things at the same time.
So it really has nothing to do with the amount of damages
correct.
That the jury awarded on each claim.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Can I move you to the punitive damages issue? At the beginning of your argument, you got a lot of questions about misrepresentation. For purposes of the punitive damages award, in fact, it really, if I'm understanding your argument correctly, it really doesn't matter that the court answered the misrepresentation claim yes, because as I look at the verdict form, the question of punitive damages, and you argue this in your brief, but I'd like to hear a little more about it. The punitive damages award is tied solely to the award of damages under the contract and for unjust enrichment, and the court itself did that under the verdict form. So in fact, punitive damages were not awarded with respect to the misrepresentation or tort claim. And I see you have a stop sign, so perhaps you can quickly answer or address.
Certainly answer Justice Bradley's question.
Thank you. That's correct, Your Honor. And in fact, even after trial, when the court was looking to determine what the cap on punitive damages would be, it totaled both the unjust enrichment and the contract damages, and that's what it based the amount of punitive damages on. So it's very clear from the record that this award is in fact based on contract and quasi-contract damages rather than tort damages, which the jury was never asked to award.
Okay,
thank you very much.
Counsel, are you ready to proceed?
I am, Your Honor.
Please.
Thank you, Chief Justice. Chief Justice Rosensack, other justices of the court, may it please the court, I represent Bones, Inc., the general contracting firm that is the respondent on this petition. We prevailed at trial after suing for breach of contract, unjust enrichment, and unjust intentional misrepresentation. Our claim damages in the case were not less than $200,000. Plus interest, exemplary damages, and attorney's fees. At the end of the day, the award was $239,249, which includes interest, and the jury awarded $1 million in punitive damages, which the judge cut to less than half of that pursuant to 895.043. The issues before the court now are first relates to discovery. And I've heard, and the question is a little bit different than it has been in the lower courts in the case. In the lower courts in the case, BMO contested that their conduct was not egregious on discovery. We showed to the Court of Appeals that chapter and verse that the trial court was correct. And the Court of Appeals affirmed the trial court's discretionary decision. Now, for the first time on this appeal, after they acknowledged that the both counsel acknowledged what the appropriate standard was, now on appeal for the first time to the Supreme Court, do they say, no, the standard is all wrong now. We shouldn't have to comply with this standard. And we need to add something more to a standard that has been in effect since 1991 in the Johnson case and by the U.S. Supreme Court back to 1972 in the Hockey League case. The purpose of the standard as it exists is so that the court can control itself. It can maintain orderly proceedings. If we had a standard like they're talking about, where every time the court wanted to do something on wanted to address discovery, the opposition could say, "No, well, they're not prejudiced. We can redo the trial. We can redo 20 depositions. We can do all these things." Where are we left? We're left with a situation.
Counsel, you're bringing to mind the severity of the sanction that the court imposed here. It was, if you will, sort of the death penalty of litigation. Another sanction could have been the judge could have made all the findings that she made and then imposed attorney fees to compensate your client for the fees that were incurred, arguably unnecessarily due to the litigation tactics, discovery tactics of BMO Harris. So that would be one way of addressing it, right?
If the court chose to do that, it could, but it found that the discovery breach was egregious. And I would have to agree. Having lived this case in the prior case when they subpoenaed BMO Harris for documents, they withheld them. They just plain deep six withheld documents. And why did they do that? Because the loan officer involved in the case gave testimony contrary to his internal documents. The internal documents showed that he was not telling the truth. When we got to after going through that whole subpoena, which by the way, they tried to quash in the first case, we asked for documents in the second case. They said, you already have everything. There's no need for any further production. And again, they concealed documents that directly impeached the testimony of their star witness. So, I mean, the court found that this was egregious conduct on discovery.
And under 804.12, I don't think anyone would dispute that the court certainly had the power to impose judgment by default as a sanction, but the statute does speak to the order being just. And if, as I'm reading that statute, could you address your argument as to whether or not or what the court has to consider in making the determination of what is just as a sanction under these circumstances?
That precise verbiage, I believe, was raised in the Johnson case. And they noted the statute requires just. And so their addressing of that was bad faith, egregious conduct had to be a standard in order for the ultimate sanction to be imposed. So, I mean, I think that's been considered and addressed by Johnson and the whole line of cases that followed it, and always with the same logic that if the courts not only do it for the case in front of them, they do it for the integrity of the justice system as a whole. And if you see somebody doing something like this on discovery, you should have this weapon in your arsenal to make the court system better. I mean, in some respects, when you say that the court can always address it by adding more fees and whatnot, there's a distinct difference between a company like Moans going after somebody like BMO. Look at where we are here today. I mean, they're calling this a $40,000 case. Why not give all the discovery that they had in there to prevent thousands of dollars, tens of thousands of dollars being spent on discovery?
So can I switch gears for a second here? What is the basis of the misrepresentation claim?
When this project was going south, and I mean right in the during the economic downturn of 2008, these condominiums were not selling. The contractor involved, Moans Inc., looked at the developer and said, "Are you going to have?" He was shaky. "Are you going to have the money?" They have all the infrastructure in. They have 20 condos built. There's some. He's thinking he doesn't have to advance money to build or work on more condominiums. He says, "I'm not going to do it unless I have assurance from the bank for money." So he goes to the bank officer and says, "Am I going to get money if I do additional work on these three condos?" The bank officer says, "There's money set aside. There's $221,000, some change, set aside in an escrow so that when you do the work, you'll get this money." That was all not true.
Is that paragraph 31 of your complaint, correct?
Yes.
Okay. So if I could just one very quick follow-up. So the misrepresentation doesn't have anything to do with BMO's conduct once the lawsuit was filed?
Well, what happened is like when after the lawsuit was filed, the bank officer had testified previous in the earlier case, and in this case, while the documents were being withheld, said, "Golly gosh, I'm sorry this happened. I didn't know that all these things were going on behind the scene. I didn't know they were talking about selling the loan and this would all be whisked away from you," when that just plain wasn't true. Those were the documents that they were withholding. And as it turned out, the contractor does the work. In my view, the bank officer perpetrated the lie, saying, "Oh yeah, just check with the buyer of the loan, you should be able to get paid," inferring to my client that there's still this mystical set aside of money out there to get paid, and that just plain was not true.
Counsel, are you saying then that the misrepresentation occurred after the lawsuit was filed as well as before the lawsuit was filed based on the conduct of BMO Harris's representatives?
Well, he misrepresented the facts at his deposition, but the dust had settled on the damage before the lawsuit certainly was commenced. I mean, we commenced the lawsuit when there was a fait accompli in terms of the facts. But after the lawsuit was filed, there still was a misrepresentation by withholding discovery, if that's what you mean.
Yeah, that's what I'm asking you about.
Counsel, the question really, what we're trying to get to is question number three. Question number three on the verdict form is based on your complaint, right? The misrepresentation Correct. Would have had to have happened prior to you filing a complaint, and it's not something that was about what happened in the failure to turn over discovery. Is that correct?
Correct. It was everything about him not getting paid and there never being a set-aside escrow or money like that.
Okay. I was asking the question basically because of what the circuit court said in regard to her going through statements that were made by BMO Harris and then saying, "But you said this, but that was a lie. You said this, but that was a lie." And she then, in her closing remarks, and when you got attorney's fees, She based part of her reasoning for giving you almost $114,000 in attorney's fees based on the misrepresentations of BMO Harris that occurred after the lawsuit was filed. So I'm trying to figure out how the damages fit together. Then she didn't put a question on the verdict purposely for misrepresentation. Okay? So maybe she thought she gave you the money for misrepresentation. I don't know. That's what I'm trying to sort out.
I think what when she was reading, she was recruiting from our discovery request, right, which were during, and that was right at the toward the beginning of the case, where what their responses were on discovery were absolutely contradicted by documents later discovered, and right, perhaps some never discovered through this whole case. In terms of the misrepresentation on the verdict, was the misrepresentation that and everybody understood it that way, that there is this set aside escrow account from which bones would be paid for. All you have to do is finish, do the work, put in his request, and you get paid.
Counsel, just to clarify, I want to make sure we're all on the same page. There is not a dispute, right, that the special verdict questions relate to the claims made in the complaint. It's the misrepresentation claim made in the complaint, not misrepresentations that might have been made during discovery.
That's correct. They're misrepresentations.
Okay. Thank you.
Can you address the argument that opposing counsel made about the inability to have both the unjust enrichment amounts and the contract amount because of the conduct, and that the statement in the verdict form can't save it? The fact that Judge Foster included without duplicating amounts from question four, that doesn't matter, that regardless, there can't be recovery for both because it's inconsistent. They're inconsistent with each other in terms of the behavior. Can you address that, please?
Yes, I don't know. I don't know why. I can understand the argument, okay? But I don't agree that it's very easy to see what the damages are on the verdict. And this was a jury that was really paying attention. I said to the court myself that if there's these damages and they're not called contract damages on the verdict, if they're not called breach of contract damages, if there's damages for his not getting the draws, the additional work he put onto the project, those damages can't be included in unjust enrichment damages. And she fashioned the verdict so that they weren't included. And the way the testimony went in, I asked the jury to award $349,000 in unjust enrichment damages, but not to include the other damages it would find in the case. And the result was within the range that they came with. And the $349,000 came from the fact that they apparently had an appraisal after Bones did the work that showed there was $349,000 in value generated from when they asked him to perform the work. Now, I know that
you have to stop just a minute because I'm not following what you're saying. Okay, so there was a difference in the appraisal for the sale price of the note that was $340,000, okay, and the damages in the verdict of $132,000 are that $340,000, then subtracting out the breach of contract damages, which are about $106,000. Is that what you're saying?
That's my interpretation here.
Okay, but aren't both unjust enrichment damages and breach of contract damages here based on the same conduct? Your clients building the condos.
Ultimately, But
there wasn't any other conduct that bore on either one, right?
No, but ultimately, Your Honor, but I mean, in some of it, there have been cases where the court, has in the past, looked at where the benefit is obtained by somebody like BMO and awarded as damages. There's a community bank case back in 1991 where a trustee of a receivership, for example, he had a contract to get paid by the court. But what did he do? He took an unfair benefit by using the receivership to generate a contract that profited him by $300,000-$400,000. The court made him pay it back. There is a remedy here that is much more poignant to me in this type of situation.
I think your pleading to me was pleading in the alternative. I don't follow the logic that you can't plead unjust enrichment and breach of contract. I think they're in the alternative. We plead in the alternative all the time. But I don't see how you can get both if both are based on the same conduct. Now, what you're telling me today is that the amount of unjust enrichment damages that are shown is not the full amount by which BMO Harris was enriched by your client's work, that really you should add them both together to have the full unjust enrichment damages. Is that what you're saying?
That is correct. I'm sorry.
Okay. All right. I understand your argument differently now. So that was a big help.
I understand that also. Is that because the judge said you can't include the $44,000? So had she just said, give us, if this is unjust enrichment, jury, what amount were they unjustly enriched? If they hadn't been told not to include four, your argument is they would have included that in five.
Correct.
Right. So if we were
still doing one remedy,
the full amount of unjust enrichment damages here, we'd have to add them together.
That's correct.
But we wouldn't be violating what opposing counsel was describing, which I understand is that you can't benefit from the same conduct twice. If you're going to take the benefit of the contract, you get the benefit of the contract. Otherwise, you have the equitable benefit, but you can't recover doubly.
Well, I get that, but I understand the argument, but to me these situations have to be fluid. I mean, if you had a person who said, I'm going to install a water heater for you, and we agreed to pay $400 $400 for the water heater. And I'm not going to pay you. So you get sued for the water heater. The guy sues you for $400 for the water heater and says, well, even though if we didn't have a contract, they're worth $350. So I want that for unjust enrichment. So I can see in that context where you don't award $750, the sum of the two for a breach of contract, but and unjust enrichment damages. Where they conflict. But there's no conflict like that because of the way that the trial court framed the verdict.
I actually do see a conflict, counsel, because when I look at question one of the special verdict, which was answered by the court, did BMO Harris breach an agreement? And the court answered that yes. Then question two, was BMO Harris unjustly enriched? And the court answered yes. So we go back to the Schrodinger's cat problem, which is we can't both have a contract and not have a contract. You pled in the alternative, and perhaps wisely so, because there wasn't actually a written contract between BMO Harris and your client, but you succeeded at least, well, to some extent in convincing the court that there was an oral contract because the court so found. So in the presence of a contract, there cannot be an unjust enrichment. You get either or. Do you concede that?
Well, I know that's their argument, but I look at it this way. The verdict questions were answered as a sanction. And if you could equally argue, why wouldn't you get unjust enrichment damages but not contract? I mean, the court answered yes through all three questions, and they all involve the same sort of conduct.
But fashioning a sanction, the court still has to follow the law, right?
I think the court did a great job in doing that. Well, when we got, and part of what's not in the discussion here so far is what happened during the instruction conference. Well, the only objection to the way the court was proceeding at the time was that opposing counsel said, if we have a verdict that has both breach of contract and unjust enrichment on it, we'll be double dipping all the way through the trial. They submitted a verdict form that had both breach of contract and unjust enrichment like that. They submitted an opening instruction saying that this was what the case was all going to be all about. When we got down to the instruction conference, then they say, well, okay, you get this, when we put $2 amounts here, this is going to be double dipping. So I think the courts that took into account what they were saying fairly addressed what they were forming a verdict to eliminate the possibility that there'd be double dipping or some confusion as to what the jury meant, and we went on with it.
Setting aside the forfeiture argument here, what I'm trying to get at is it seems to me, and it's pretty clear to me based on my years of practice and years on the bench, that you either get contract or you get equity. You don't get both. So what I'm trying to, as a first principle, see what your position is on that. I understand your argument to mean to suggest that, well, there wasn't double dipping. I get that, but I have to go back to those first two questions to determine whether or not the court's verdict was proper.
Well, nobody objected to the court answering the first two questions in the way
it did. Set aside the forfeiture.
In reality, there's so many cases where you submit both breach of contract and unjust enrichment on the same verdict. The Swigel case that they're talking about had both. This is not uncommon practice.
Right, but that would be when it's left to the jury to determine whether or not there was a contract in the first instance, and that goes back to the pleading and the alternative, right?
I suppose, with the that would leave it as a jury question on the thing. But I really don't see a problem with what the court did, given there's a sanction ruling.
I want to talk about the jury instruction conference a little more. I'm trying to figure out on the form that went back to the jury, the verdict form, on the back top of the back page, it says, if you awarded damages to any component of question four or question five, which were the breach of contract and the unjust enrichment, then answer this question. And then it was a question about whether or not BMO acted maliciously towards your client or in an intentional disregard of the rights of Moans. It's the punitive damages question. It seems like it is teed up, though, on those two, the contract and the quasi-contract claim. And so can you help me understand that lead-in if you awarded damages to any component of?
Okay. The first component on question number four, again, doesn't say contract damages. It says damages for these items. And frankly, in this case, if you're, one of their complaints is there should be something for misrepresentation damages, they never articulate how they would be any different. I mean, how would the misrepresentation damages be any different than these, including the ones for the benefit of the conferred on BMO? When we got to the instruction conference, the judge sensed that. And I believe, if I'm just working from memory, but at day three of the transcript at about page 171, the court said, we don't want to muddy the waters with a separate misrepresentation damage question. I think in the overall sense, the trial court was very interested in making sure you had a verdict that didn't duplicate damages, and it didn't call question number four contract damages. So I totally disagree with opposing counsel where they say, well, there's no tort proven claimed here because the damages here are tort damages as well as contract damages. And the court did not characterize them, particularly in question number four, as contract damages. So those would be the same damages a person would sustain for the misrepresentation.
Let me just flesh that out. And I see the wording of number four, but if you were to say, let's just say that this was in the alternative, which it was pled that way, and that's the way it would need to be, what would be the damages for the contract if it's not number four? That's really the only damages on here.
Four would be the contract, the combination would be the unjust enrichment, and the damages for the misrepresentation would, depending on how you view the law, look at either the contract or the combination. There are cases.
Wait, did you just say?
Go ahead.
I'm just trying to follow as well. Did you say, I thought you just said four was for the breach of contract.
If you looked at which damages would relate to breach of contract, the damage four relate to multiple, all three causes of action, but in a different way. But are they, if you look to where the breach of contract damages would be, you would go to question number four. If you went to where the unjust enrichment would be, that'd be add four and five. If you went to whichever the misrepresentation damages, you would go to four and five.
Okay, but misrepresentation's a tort.
Yes.
Four and five are a contract. They're two separate types of claims that actually election of damages would potentially have you have to pick. So how can the misrepresentation damages be four and five?
Because four for certain, because you have, if you have somebody misrepresented to you, as they did here, that there's money in escrow to have you paid, you can legitimately claim I was frauded, and my damages are or include what you failed to pay me.
Counsel, I think that the measure of damages for the three claims are quite different. Unjust enrichment is measured by the amount the defendant benefited from the conduct of the plaintiff. So it's a benefit to the defendant, and I think that's the way you explained it to us, and I think that's correct as a matter of law. Damages for misrepresentation are the out-of-pocket damages to the plaintiff because of the misrepresentation. Breach of contract are the damages consequential and actual that arise from the misrepresentation. So that, you know, there are different tests. I mean, there are different measures for damages. I can see how you might fit misrepresentation into the answer to question four, because you could say, well, they were out of pocket for these draw items because there wasn't the money there to pay. But it couldn't fit into unjust enrichment because the measure is totally different. Unjust enrichment is how much did the defendant benefit from the tortious or from the, and that's the question. I had my law clerk looking forever to find out if unjust enrichment ever sounds as a tort rather than a contract. And we couldn't find it anywhere. But the damages are how much did the defendant benefit, which is quite different from a contract claim where the plaintiff is trying to assert rights of the plaintiff rather than a benefit to the defendant. So this is a very interesting case, but more complicated underneath than it looks.
I have the stop sign here, but can I tell you where my research
substitutions? Yes. Yeah. No.
ProPack Inc. versus WOW Logistics. It's a Seventh Circuit case, 721 F3rd 781, and I'm looking at 786 to 77, they refer to an unpublished Wisconsin Court of Appeal case called N Air Services, Inc. versus Link, which is 212 WISAP 27. And I still go back to this court's Community National Bank versus Medical Benefit Administrators case, because there, breach of fiduciary duty is most certainly a tort, and the damages awarded by the court were disgorgement of the unjust enrichment.
Yeah, well, okay. All right, well, I'll go back and I'll read those cases. I looked and looked, and I couldn't find a clear statement. My law clerk couldn't find a clear statement.
I agree.
Okay, well, thank you very much. Counsel, are you ready for rebuttal?
I am, Your Honor. Thank you very much. It's certainly possible to plead in the alternative, but you can't win on both. And by the time the parties headed to trial, we were all stuck with the court's finding that there was a contract. That precludes both unjust enrichment and punitive damages. And let me use as an example the example counsel mentioned. If suppose you hire someone to install a water heater in your house and you agree to pay $800 for it, that's your contract. But it turns out that the water heater is worth $2,000. You can't choose or elect to pursue the $2,000 when you agreed to pay the $800. The existence of the contract as a matter of logic and election of remedies, the existence of the contract prevents there from being any unjust enrichment or punitive damages for that matter.
Now you and could by turn the way, that on its head too, couldn't you? And say the award of liability for unjust enrichment prevents the breach of contract damage.
But before we look to whether there can be unjust enrichment, we ask whether there was a contract governing the parties.
Well, there's no written contract here, so we're going to have to imply one. I think that this is a little bit more fluid than if you had a contract that was written down.
That may be so, Your
Honor. And there's
Honor,
been a denial all the way through that there was any contract paid. So.
But the judge instructed the jury that there was a contract and answered the question yes. That's the way the case went to the trial, and that should preclude the unjust enrichment award. And our objections, by the way,
but the judge also answered the question yes for unjust enrichment, too.
That's correct, and they're fundamentally
and misrepresentation.
And none of it can stand, and it has to be sent back for that reason, because the judge's conclusions were fundamentally inconsistent, and we can't understand how it affected the verdict, so it has to be reversed.
Okay, we agree with you and send it back. What are you proposing we send it back for? If we agree with you that the verdict form is, for lack of a better word, a bit of a mess legally, do we have to have another jury trial? I think you're asking us to, if we agree with your position, we disagree with your position on the imposition of the sanction, but we agree with your position with respect to contract damages versus unjust enrichment damages. What is the precise relief you're requesting?
Well, I think it would have to go back for an evaluation of the inconsistency in the first two points question one and question two. That would be the first question for the court. What are you going to tell the jury was the contract and what were its terms, or was there no contract? I mean, the inconsistency actually begins with the sanction and is tied to the fact that there are no findings that the judge in entering the sanction didn't say, here are the facts I'm finding. The judge just said, I grant liability. So we would have to sort that out first.
So it would have to go back for another jury trial.
I think it would have to go back for another jury trial, yes, because we... Apologies.
That's okay. Go ahead.
Excuse me. It's too convoluted right now for us to discern now what happened and dissect it. So it would have to go back for another jury trial.
Counsel, I did want to... Excuse me, counsel. Your opposing counsel indicated that you advanced jury instructions for both and judges for all of the causes of action and advances a forfeiture argument. Could you respond to that, that at the conference itself, the instruction conference, that you made the necessary objections to the form of the verdict?
Your Honor, if you examine the instruction conference, and particularly, for example, at Appendix 165, this is one example, it's very clear that the argument counsel was making for BMO was not just about don't duplicate the numbers. It was about the basic premise of sending a contract claim, of having a contract claim and an unjust enrichment claim before the jury at the same time. For example, quoting, it is inconsistent in a case to have both breach of contract and unjust enrichment. A finding that there was a contract and there was unjust enrichment is rife with problems, and that's why we are objecting. So there's an extended discussion of this in the record. And in fact, the judge at the end of it said, I may be making new law, but the appellate courts will do their job to sort it out. So there's no question that it was fully hashed out in front of the court. I do want to speak briefly about the issue of misrepresentation. What I heard counsel saying here was that there was a promise made that a representation made that all Moans had to do. Your Honor, with your indulgence, could I finish my?
Yes, you can finish your statement.
Thank you. The misrepresentation I heard today was you will get paid if you submit your invoice. There was never a representation to that effect. There was never an escrow. What there was is a loan with draw amounts and special requirements for each draw amount. And none of the three draw amounts here satisfied those requirements. There was never a representation made that Moans would be paid no matter what, as long as it did the work. It had to meet certain requirements, and it didn't. And a subsequent bank is the one that concluded, not even BMO, that these draw requests shouldn't be paid.
Okay. Thank you, counsel. And thank you very much for assisting the court with oral argument in this forum. I know it isn't perfect. At the moment, it's about the best we can do. And Wisconsin is really under siege by COVID at the moment. So your briefs were very, very helpful. I find the case tremendously interesting because I keep finding more questions in it than I get answers. But thank you for fine oral arguments, and thank you for your briefs. They were very well done. So we will take a brief recess now while we get ready for our second case of the morning. We are adjourned. Thank you.
Thank you.